Chapter 7. About 90 or 800 feet from the top, the remains of my vest caught on a projecting rock, and I was almost drowned before I could get loose. I finally fell, and brought up in a world of white foam at the foot of the fall, whose silt and bubbly masses towered up several inches above my head. Of course I got into a yeti. I sailed round and round in it 44 times, chasing a chip, and gaining on it each round trip a half mile, reaching for the same bush on the bank 44 times, and just exactly missing it by a hair's breadth every time. At last a man walked down, and sat down close to that bush, and put a pipe in his mouth, and lit a match, and followed me with one eye, and kept the other on the match, while he sheltered it in his hands from the wind. Presently a puff of wind blew it out. The next time I swept around he said, "Got a match?" "Yes, in my other vest. Help me out please." "Not for Joe." When I came round again, I said, "Excuse the seemingly impertinent curiosity of a drowning man, but will you explain this singular conduct of yours?" "With pleasure. I am the coroner. Don't hurry on my account. I can wait for you. But I wish I had a match. I said call and take my place, and I'll go and get you one." He declined. This lack of confidence on his part created a coldness between us, and from that time forward I avoided him. It was my idea, in case anything happened to me, to so timely occurrence, as to throw my custom into the hands of the opposition coroner on the American side. At last a policeman came along, and arrested me for disturbing the peace, by yelling at people on shore for help. The judge fined me, but at the advantage of him. My money was with my pantaloons, and my pantaloons were with the Indians. Thus I escaped. I am now lying in a very critical condition. At least I am lying anyway, dash critical or not critical. I am hurt all over, but I cannot tell the full extent yet, because the doctor is not done taking inventory. He will make out my manifest this evening. However, thus far he thinks only 16 of my wounds are fatal. I don't mind the others. Upon regaining my right mind, I said, "It is an awful savage tribe of Indians that do the beadwork and moccasins for Niagara Falls, doctor. Where are they from?" "Limerick, my son." Answers to correspondence written about 1865. Moral statistician. I don't want any of your statistics. I took your whole batch and lit my pipe with it. I hate your kind of people. You are always ciphering out how much a man's health is injured, and how much his intellect is impaired, and how many pitiful dollars and cents he wastes in the course of 92 years' indulgence in the fatal practice of smoking, and in the equally fatal practice of drinking coffee, and in playing billiards occasionally, and in taking a glass of wine at dinner, etc., etc., etc. And you are always figuring out how many women have been burned to death, because of the dangerous fashion of wearing expansive hoops, etc., etc., etc. You never see more than one side of the question. You are blind to the fact that most old men in America smoke and drink coffee, although, according to your theory, they ought to have died young, and that hardy old Englishmen drink wine and survive it, and portly old Dutchmen both drink and smoke freely, and yet grow older and fatter all the time. And you never buy to find out how much solid comfort, relaxation, and enjoyment a man derives from smoking in the course of a lifetime which is worth 10 times the money he would save by letting it alone, nor the appalling aggregate of happiness lost in a lifetime your kind of people from not smoking. Of course you can save money, by denying yourself all the little vicious enjoyments for 50 years, but then what can you do with it? What use can you put it to? Money can't save your infinitesimal soul. All the use that money can be put to is to purchase comfort and enjoyment in this life. Therefore, as you are an enemy to comfort and enjoyment, where is the use of accumulating cash? It won't do for you, say, that you can use it to better purpose in furnishing a good table, and in charities, and in supporting tract societies, because you know yourself that you people who have no petty vices are never known to give away a cent, and that you stint yourselves so in the matter of food, that you are always feeble and hungry. And you never dare to laugh in the daytime for fear some poor wretch, seeing you in a good humor, will try to borrow a dollar of you. And in church you are always down on your knees, with your eyes buried in the cushion, when the contribution box comes around. And you never give the revenue officer full statement of your income. Now you know these things yourself, don't you? Very well, then what is the use of your stringing out your miserable lives to a lean and withered old age? What is the use of your saving money that is so utterly worthless to you? In a word, why don't you go off somewhere and die, and not be always trying to seduce people into becoming as ornery and unlovable as you are yourselves, by your villainous oral statistics? Now I don't approve of dissipation, and I don't indulge in it either. But I haven't a particle of confidence in a man who has no redeeming petty vices, and so I don't want to hear from you anymore. I think you are the very same man who read me a long lecture last week about the degrading vice of smoking cigars, and then came back, in my absence, with your reprehensible fireproof gloves on, and carried off my beautiful parlor stove. Young author. Yes, Agassiz does recommend authors to eat fish, because the phosphorus in it makes brain. So far you are correct. But I cannot help you to a decision about the amount you need to eat, at least, not with certainty. If the specimen composition you send is about your fair usual average, I should judge that perhaps a couple of whales would be all you would want for the present. Not the largest kind, but simply good, middling-sized whales. Simon Wheeler, Sonora. The following simple and touching remarks and accompanying poem have just come to hand from the rich gold mining region of Sonora. To Mr. Mark Twain. The Within Parson, which I have set to poetry under the name and style of Eden His Level Best, was one among the whitest men I ever see, and it ain't every man that knowed him that can find it in his heart to say he's glad the poor cuss is busted and gone home to the States. He was here in an early day, and he was the handiest man about taking hold of anything that come along you most ever see, I judge. He was a cheerful, stern critter, always doing something, and no man can say he ever see him do anything by halves. Preaching was his natural gait, but he warned a man to lay back a twiddle his thumbs, because there didn't happen to be nothing due in his own special line. No, sir, he was a man who would meander forth and stir up something for hisself. His last acts was to go his pile on ings and calcating to fill, but which he didn't fill, when there was a lush out of gin him, and naturally, you see, he went under. And so he was cleaned out, as you may say, and he struck the home trail, cheerful but flat broke. I know this talented man in Arkansas, and if you would print this humbly tribute to his gorgeous abilities, you would greatly oblige his unhappy friend. He done his level best. Was he a mining on the flat? He done it with a zest. Was he a leading of the choir? He done his level best. If he'd a reglar task to do, he never took no rest. Or if 'twas off and on the same, he done his level best. If he was preaching on his beat, he'd tramp from east to west, and north to south in cold, and he done his level best. He'd yank a sinner out in Hades, and land him with the blessed. Then snatch a prayer and waltz in again, and do his level best. Here I have taken a slight liberty with the original MS. 8 does not make such good meter as the other word of one syllable, but it sounds better. He'd cuss and sing, and howl and pray, and dance and drink and jest, and lie and steal all one to him. He done his level best. Whatever this man was sought to do, he done it with a zest. No matter what his contract was, he'd do his level best. Verily, this man was gifted with gorgeous abilities, and it is a happiness to me to embalm the memory of their luster in these columns. If it were not that the poet crop is unusually large and rank in California this year, I would encourage you to continue writing, Simon Wheeler. But, as it is, perhaps it might be too risky in you to enter against so much opposition. Professional beggar. No, you are not obliged to take greenbacks at par. Milton Mowbray, Dutch Flat. This correspondent sends a lot of doggerel, and says it has been regarded as very good in Dutch Flat. I give a specimen verse. The Assyrian came down like a wolf on the fold, and his cohorts were gleaming with purple and gold, and the sheen of his spears was like stars on the sea, when the blue wave rolls nightly on deep Galilee. This piece of pleasantry, published in a San Francisco paper, was mistaken by the country journals for seriousness, and many and loud were the denunciations of the ignorance of author and editor, in not knowing that the lines in question were written by Byron. There, that will do. That may be very good Dutch Flat poetry, but it won't do in the metropolis. It is too smooth and blubbery. It reads like buttermilk gurgling from a jug. What the people ought to have is something spirited, something like Oni Comes Marching Home. However, keep on practicing, and you may succeed yet. There is genius in you, but too much blubber. T. Claire Higgins, Los Angeles. Why life is a failure, I have adored, wildly, madly, and she whom I love has turned coldly from me and shed her affections upon another. What would you advise me to do? You should set your affections on another also, or on several, if there are enough to go round. Also, do everything you can to make your former flame unhappy. There is an absurd idea disseminated in novels, that the happier a girl is with another man, the happier it makes the old loveress he has blighted. Don't allow yourself to believe any such nonsense as that. The more cause that girl finds to regret that she did not marry you, the more comfortable you will feel over it. It isn't poetical, but it is mighty sound doctrine. Arithmeticus. Virginia, Nevada. If it would take a cannonball 3 1/3 seconds to travel 4 miles, and 3 3/8 seconds to travel the next 4, and 3 5/8 to travel the next 4, and if its rate of progress continued to diminish in the same ratio, how long would it take it to go 1,500 million miles? I don't know. Ambitious Learner, Oakland. Yes, you are right, America was not discovered by Alexander Selkirk. Iskirted Lover. Loved, and still love, the beautiful Edwitha Howard, and intended to marry her. Yet, during my temporary absence at Venetia, last week, alas, she married Jones. Is my happiness to be thus blasted for life? Have I no redress? Of course you have. All the law, written and unwritten, is on your side. The intention and not the act constitutes crime, in other words, constitutes the deed. If you call your bosom friend a fool, and intend it for an insult, it is an insult. But if you do it playfully, and meaning no insult, it is not an insult. If you discharge a pistol accidentally, and kill a man, you can go free, for you have done no murder. But if you try to kill a man, and manifestly intend to kill him, but fail utterly to do it, the law still holds that the intention constituted the crime, and you are guilty of murder. Ergo, if you had married Edwitha accidentally, and without really intending to do it, you would not actually be married to her at all, because the act of marriage could not be complete without the intention. And ergo, in the strict spirit of the law, since you deliberately intended to marry Edwitha, and didn't do it, you are married to her all the same because, as I said before, the intention constitutes the crime. It is as clear as day that Edwitha is your wife, and your address lies in taking a club, and mutilating Jones with it as much as you can. Any man has a right to protect his own wife from the advances of other men. But you have another alternative. You were married to Edwitha first, because of your deliberate intention, and now you can prosecute her for bigamy, in subsequently marrying Jones. But there is another phase in this complicated case. You intended to marry Edwitha, and consequently, according to law, she is your wife. There is no getting around that. But she didn't marry you, and if she never intended to marry you, you are not her husband, of course. Ergo, in marrying Jones, she was guilty of bigamy, because she was the wife of another man at the time. Which is all very well as far as it goes, but then, don't you see, she had no other husband when she married Jones, and consequently she was not guilty of bigamy. Now, according to this view of the case, Jones married a spinster, who was a widow at the same time, and another man's wife at the same time, and yet who had no husband, and never had one, and never had any intention of getting married, and therefore, of course, never had been married. And by the same reasoning you are a bachelor, because you have never been anyone's husband, and a married man, because you have a wife living. And to all intents and purposes a widower, because you have been deprived of that wife, and a consummate ass for going off to Benicia in the first place, while things were so mixed. And by this time I have got myself so tangled up in the intricacies of this extraordinary case, that I shall have to give up any further attempt to advise you. I might get confused, and fail to make myself understood. I think I could take up the argument where I left off, and by following it closely a while, perhaps I could prove to your satisfaction, either that you never existed at all, or that you are dead now, and consequently don't need the faithless Edwitha. I think I could do that, if it would afford you any comfort. Arthur Augustus. No, you are wrong. That is the proper way, to throw a brick batter a tomahawk. But it doesn't answer so well for a bouquet. You will hurt somebody, if you keep it up. Turn your nosegay upside down, take it by the stems, and toss it with an upward sweep. Did you ever pitch quoits? That is the idea. The practice of recklessly heaving immense solid bouquets, of the general size and weight of prize cabbages, from the dizzy altitude of the galleries, is dangerous and very reprehensible. Now, night before last, at the Academy of Music, just Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.